The city is stunned by a rash of recent shootings. The bids narrow down to buy JEA and make it private. Speaking of privatization, could downtown parking and parking meters also soon be in private hands? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. They are in studio and ready to go along with you. Call us up now. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can eat your way through a local mall this weekend, all thanks to the generosity of caring chefs. That's later. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a head-spinning week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Radio host Angela Spears of Angela Spears Communications is here.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And regular contributor, Charles Griggs.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have all of you here. There is so much to go into this week. Everything from a push in the city to ban internet cafes, the departure of Jalen Ramsey, the possible sale of JEA. We'll get to all of that in a few minutes, but we're going to begin this morning with a look back at the rash of violence that happened here in the city. A huge round of shootings across town this week. Police are investigating more than, I believe, a dozen separate shooting incidents that that have left a number of people hospitalized. It is simply unbelievable. We're going to begin with this, and we're already getting your calls. 549-2937. Call us up with your thoughts. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Dan Scanlon, you cover the JSO and crime in this city for the Florida Times-Union. In one night alone, there were six people injured in four separate shooting incidents on the city's west side. But that's not all that happened this week.
I woke up this morning to two more ears alerts. Those are the police alerts that news media gets. There was a shooting on Edenfield Road, and there was a shooting on Seaboard Avenue. To my knowledge, neither were fatal. By my count, that is 12 people injured and one killed this week. One of those that you talked about on the west side, four people in a car going for a fight, and whoever was there to meet them opens fire, leaves four bullet holes in the vehicle, two injured. That's just one of a number. Victims, sometimes lucky enough to go to the hospital where the cops found them. Others found there with bullet wounds.
Angela Spears, the mayor and JSO have championed the nationally renowned program Cure Violence to try to get a handle on gun violence in the city of Jacksonville. It is operating in some neighborhoods. So far, it does not seem to be working, although its supporters say give it time.
Give it time, Melissa. Yes, they're going out. The Cure Violence program is working on in Northwest Jacksonville and on the east side, where you have the people who they're calling violence interrupters, who are going out talking, Melissa, with those people, those shooters, the victims, the families. And yes, we have to give it time because it's not going to happen overnight. When we see this, when it's happening, Dan and I were talking about this beforehand. Like, where do we start, right? Sometimes it has to start at home. It's about exposure, I think, exposing our kids to different things, mentors, us as community leaders, business leaders, getting out, talking with our kids, working with programs like Cure Violence, working with the city programs. So we can't just program our way out of it. We have to sometimes, too, Melissa, I think, we have to work together. We have to work as a city to stop this because it has to stop. And it's hard to keep pace with what's happening
you
so much.
You can barely keep up with
it's so hard.
The sheer volume of shootings and violence. Charles Griggs, you know, for people that are from this area or have lived here a long time and followed this for many years, there's just an incredible sadness and weariness with this. You know, what is it going to take for this city to get a handle on this incredibly tragic and bloody public health crisis?
Well, Melissa, what we continue to hear from the community is that what's missing is a long-term strategic approach to dealing with violence. And that not only includes violence, but it includes dealing with root causes of violence in a community. You know, we've said this before in the show, I don't know how many times, but we had a program called the Jacksonville Journey that addressed these conditions across the board. The first 4 years, we saw a reduction in violence almost cut in half. And the program you know, over two administrations, pretty much just went away, evaporated for lack of funding, for lack of interest, for politics, or whatever you want to call it. But that was the closest thing we had to a long-term strategic approach. Many people feel like that program should have been improved upon and moved along so that we could be continue to become a model for how you address violence in the community from a prevention standpoint.
Full disclosure, you were involved with one of the committees on the Jacksonville Journey. So was I. Yeah. I was asked to sit on a public relations committee at one point. Just want to make sure people are clear on that.
And I served on the oversight committee, too, for all 8 years. And so I was one of two members of the oversight committee that served a full 2-8-year term. And so that just speaks to, you know, what we know about our community. There's a lot of information out there that can be utilized to help move this issue forward.
And so, Tim Gibbons, the idea of a long-term strategic plan, as Charles is saying, is one that would transcend different mayoral administrations.
Right, and that was the idea with the journey. It's the idea of, you know, it's one of the ways Jacksonville tries to arrange things like the DIA, you know, all of the independent authorities. The idea is you set these up, you kind of move them a little bit out of the political process in order to have some continuity. But I remember, you know, I covered the journey for a couple years, and one of the challenges is that idea of how do you show it's working? And the journey actually had some good metrics, but it is a long-term thing. It's not a set a program up and then have it fix things immediately. It's set things up so that the 7-year-olds of today don't become the 17-year-old shooters, you know, of a decade from now. And frankly, that's not necessarily the attention span that people have. People want something
immediate,
to come in
quick
and fix
fixes.
It. Yeah. And quick fixes obviously boost optimism about the program, but this is not a short-term problem that developed. It's not a short-term problem to be fixed.
And it's not 17-year-olds. It's 14 and 15-year-olds. I have written just this week of 14 and 15-year-olds. I've written this month on victims as well as suspects who are that age and some being charged as adults. You talk about programs that I think work, and you just had the head of the Police Athletic League program on a week or so ago. That is a program in the inner city in a zip code that is rife with homicides, mm-hmm. and working with the kids. And I can't think of a better role model than a cop who's out there sweating his or her tail off in a basketball game, fairly playing with the kids in the neighborhood. And I seem to think that program works, and that's just one that does show results. But you're right, Tim. It's going to take 10 years for that 7-year-old in Powell to become the 17-year-old who's got a full-time job and going to school and showing the results of caring.
And it's about creating, like you're saying, it's about creating, like I said earlier, creating those opportunities like Powell is creating. It's about, Melissa, creating economic development. We need more jobs. We need more businesses to come in, especially in these areas. On the north side, in on the west side, more jobs to come into the areas to give people hope, to say, hey, let me expose you to this life. Let me expose you to, hey, good things can happen and they are happening.
Well, one of the things that we've done in this community, we've been really good at, is investing in other areas of town that are not going to have an impact on violence. You know, what we need to do is invest in areas of town, you know, have your own redevelopment project or, you know, for lack of a better term, a lot J for the urban core to say we believe in all of the things that need to be done, all of the things that need to be invested in within this community to help solve some of these problems.
Almost a Marshall Plan focused long term on creating safer neighborhoods and creating more prosperous neighborhoods,
right,
is what advocates of this idea say Jacksonville needs.
It's easy for me as somebody who, you know, edits the Business Journal to go, I'm not saying business can solve all things, but yeah, if you have a job, if you have companies that open up and hire people and people can see that there is a path forward. Now there's other things that have to be done. This is not a simple sort of thing. There's a reason companies are not setting up operations in those areas. There's an educational thing that you need a skilled workforce. You know, there are programs that will help train people to be the workers that company needs. There's transportation issues. I mean, the idea of how do you get workers to work if they don't have regular transportation is a challenge in a city the size of Jacksonville. It's not a simple problem.
Let's go to your calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We are talking about the biggest stories of the week this morning with Tim Gibbons, Charles Griggs, Dan Scanlon, Angela Spears, and myself, beginning with just a head-spinning volume of violence that has struck this city once again over the last week. What are your thoughts and comments? 549-2937. Curtis is on the north side right now. Hi, Curtis. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning to you and your group. My question is this. Correct me, guys, if I'm wrong. Did I hear that the Southern leadership, civil rights leaders, are coming to town to talk and lobby for keeping the game rooms open when we have mass murders, mass shootings, and would someone please call it out? It's black-on-black crime. I can't believe they're coming to lobby for a gambling room instead of trying to save lives. I'll take my ass off there. Thank you so much.
Well, that's correct. We did get a news release yesterday.
We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Yeah. But, you know, we do try to discuss all of the headlines from the week, which we'll do later. But
he has.
But of course, he makes an important point. What is more important than this right now? Not much. Is securing the safety of our local citizens so that people aren't afraid that their children are going to be gunned down in the streets of Jacksonville.
Here's the indicator. If you look at a lot of these police reports, they are indicating that the violent crimes and gangs divisions of the sheriff's office are investigating. So there is obviously some hint that gangs are getting in each other's faces, and this is how they're solving their issues, with gunfire.
So which means that you need to get to them before they become gang members.
Correct.
And which speaks to dealing with root causes, which speaks to dealing with neighborhoods, which speaks to dealing with jobs, which speaks to dealing with education, and which is something that this community has to be bold enough to invest in over the long term and treat it as if it is a priority. I mean, we cannot continue to deal with these issues as if they are, we're reacting to them every single time. We have the crime center, we have ShotSpotter, we have, you know, all of these programs that are dealing on the back end, and we haven't invested enough. And this is what we're hearing from the community. We haven't invested enough
on
prevention.
Yeah, SpotShotter, also known as gunshot detection technology.
ShotSpotter.
Excuse me, ShotSpotter.
I do it too.
It uses sensors to pick up the sounds of gunfire to help law enforcement officers respond to incidents. That is certainly a technology that police value in terms of finding who did the shooting, who might be injured. But as Charles pointed out, by the time you get to that point, you're only responding to a societal failure.
Right, and Sheriff Williams has unfortunately pointed out that ShotSpotter is in lieu of a neighbor who cares enough to make a 911 call, that's how they find out about the shooting. And then maybe, such as last week on West 5th Street with the homicide, they did receive two 911 calls about gunfire, but they were two separate ShotSpotter hits of gunfire. That's what called the cops.
Tracy is in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I am a resident of Jacksonville for 40 years, and I think I am seeing this going around and around on banning the gun and all that. Maybe it's not a good suggestion, but anytime somebody go and buy a gun, tell them if you're buying a gun, you have to have $10 million insurance to protect the other family if something happens. I wonder how many people will buy the gun then if they have to buy the heavy-duty insurance, and that will cut down the crime and the lives lost. I will take myself off the air.
Thanks for that. You know, the issue of gun violence and gun reform will certainly be dominating discussions over the next year during the presidential race. It's a divisive issue here in Florida in particular, but that is one of many possible reforms that has been put forth by a whole panoply of people and groups. The one that has the most bipartisan universal support is increased background checks for weapons purchases and closing the gun show loophole so that it's harder to buy a gun if you have not passed a background check. Charles.
Well, using the gun is, you know, sort of like being able to use the keys on the keyboard. You still have to be able to think about what you're doing, you know, prior to typing information. And if they have the mindset that they're going to use a gun, then they're going to use a gun. They're going to use their own gun, and they're going to use someone else's gun. So I think under the circumstances, what we have going on in our community, gun laws are probably going to do, you know, minimum to help solve the problem that we have. This is about people understanding you know, that they have a future and they have a positive future, they have a place in society. And when you get people to feel, to be able to trust the government and the community that they're in, the environment they live in, then these mindsets will change and people will realize that they do not have to go out and murder each other.
Rick on the South Side, go ahead, Rick.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Melissa. I just want to ask one quick question. My question is, every time this conversation come up, we always talk about investing in our community. We need jobs. My quick question is this. Who do we need to talk to in order to get these jobs on our side of town? Is it the mayor, the city council? I mean, who do we need to talk to? And that'd be my question.
Okay, thanks for that. And we're getting tweets criticizing local leadership about this story. Here's a tweet from Travis. 12 people shot, one killed in Jacksonville this week alone, over 6 shootings in 7 days. Mayor Lenny Curry continues to fail in his primary job of protecting our community. Growing the police force is only a Band-Aid. This is a public health crisis. We need a long-term strategy. Okay, the mayor, the sheriff, and ultimately the buck stops with them. What about that?
I mean, particularly with the way that we run campaigns in Jacksonville, where public safety is a perennial topic of people bashing the person who had the job before them, saying they didn't do enough. I think particularly in this administration, Mayor Curry came in with a...
That was his signature issue.
That was his signature issue. Right, I'm going to come in and fix this. And so I think it's at least fair to address that issue.
And what about the JSO? Let's talk about how they're responding to this. Because as we were saying, it's not their job to prevent violence. It's their job to respond to it. You know, and certainly they are working as hard as they possibly can, using all the technology, all the tools available. But you, as you pointed out, Dan, in a number of neighborhoods, still today in Jacksonville, people are reluctant to work with police, talk to them. That's a big issue, too.
First Coast Crime Stoppers is the way to anonymously tip, and that's been pushed a lot in the past few weeks, with the proof, Wally Hodges, who's in charge, saying that we never, ever tell who's calling. So it is truly anonymous. So that is one inducement, and up to $3,000 if your tip results in an arrest.
I think that what people in the public would like to see, you know, the community, you know, our community moves at the speed of trust, right?
And if there isn't trust,
right? So what we know is the sheriff's office got an extra $30 million to do what they were trying to do, what they need to do. They say they need to do for this community, which is fine, but you have to show the same level of commitment to other areas of social understanding and how the community is moving in the wrong direction. You have to show people that you're willing to invest in the same types of things, in the same way that you are in ways for your crime prevention pieces. And we haven't done that. The level of commitment has not been there.
And so the trust isn't there.
The trust isn't there.
Yeah. Linda, go ahead, Angela.
I was just going to say that trust does need to be gained. You know, Dan mentioned earlier programs like Jack's Pal working in the neighborhood, right? Getting back to that old-fashioned, Melissa, when you and I were in the news, that old-fashioned community policing, whether out in the street, just hanging out, just talking with people in the neighborhood. That's one way to, I think officers can build that trust, is if you know the people in the neighborhood. If they know you, then they'll be willing to talk with you about issues.
Okay, and if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest headlines from the week. It's 549-2937 to join us. We're going to shift gears now and talk about the other big story from the last few days. JEA has narrowed its field of potential bidders down to 9. All of this is the utility, and City Hall continues to draw criticism for what critics say is a lack of transparency around the sale of the publicly owned utility. It's an idea that's remarkably unpopular with most people in Duval County who would be affected by the sale, and some folks outside the county. Here are the investor-owned utilities that go on to the next stage. Duke Energy, NextEra Energy, and EMRA. NextEra is the parent company of Florida Power and Light. EMRA owns Tampa Electric and Peoples Gas. Here are some other names in the mix: Macquarie Infrastructure and Real Assets, Inc., And there's some other names that you might not recognize. Suez, a firm based in France. So there's global interest, Tim Gibbons, as you've been reporting in the Business Journal, in buying JEA.
Wow. Well, clearly this, you know, global conglomerates being interested in buying JEA is just one more sign that the business is dying and clearly we have to exit it.
That's a little sarcasm for you.
Never.
But I mean, clearly there has been a lot of interest. This is an interesting point in the process. Most of these companies' names, there's one of the nine companies has not had its name revealed because it wouldn't give permission, which is a unusual strategy of asking the companies if they will have their names revealed. There seems to be a general sense that this is just moving ahead without a lot of support outside of JEA and perhaps City Hall, and most of it is happening behind closed doors.
Now, theoretically, the city council has some oversight over this process. They could theoretically vote to stop the sale of JEA. They can also vote to kick this to a voter referendum.
It will be going to city council at the end. But the interesting bit is JEA has been very clear that they're an independent authority and they're going to move ahead. They're going to come up with what they believe is the best deal and then forward that to city council for a vote. City council members, we had a story this morning. City council members met yesterday to kind of figure out what role do they have. There are some who want to actually have under oath hearings with JEA executives. There are some taking a more conciliatory sort of tone, but council pretty much has been frozen out, as has much of the public.
They're getting their own lawyer. They're calling for their own committee hearings on this. They're coming to life, essentially, in terms of exercising oversight.
And you know, it's interesting, Melissa, people who I've been talking with, they still go back to the fact, wasn't it about a year or so ago that we thought this was like a dead issue. When people said that, no, they didn't want it, and it was just gone? And people are just wondering, how did this come back up again? And, you know, another person came up and told me one day, you know, I'm hearing that this is basically a done deal, that it's going to happen. It's just they're putting this out there just for us to see.
That's causing a lot of angst and anger among the constituents out there. And certainly the city council members we've spoken with say they're hearing from their constituents. They're not happy about this process. They are weighing in vocally. The question, I think, is, will they get the chance to weigh in on a referendum?
If nothing else, what we've learned is that there needs to be a review of the procurement process, if nothing else, because nothing should be able to be conducted in secret. And I think that's what the public is, and council members as well, believe that that's what's going on. And the perception is that, like Angela mentioned, that this is a foregone conclusion, and that what's going to happen is once this deal is negotiated, then the council has an opportunity to do something. And I think that's what people kind of expect, you know, some type of way around this deal to come forward at that particular point in time. And that's what I'm hearing, is that, you know, we feel like that no matter what the JEA comes up with, this is a done deal. Otherwise, they wouldn't be moving this train down the track as fast
as
they are.
A listener named Frank tweets the show, "The sale of JEA is nothing but political corruption aimed to increase the wealth of the mayor's donors."
I think the interesting thing about this feeling that there is a lack of transparency is, In some ways, it sidesteps the entire question of, is it a good idea to sell JEA?
And let's talk about the pros and cons of doing this.
But before we get to that, the idea that if you actually believe that selling JEA is the best possible thing, that it's a necessary thing to do, it's an odd approach to then tick a bunch of people off by doing it in a way that feels like it's being done in secrecy, like people are being cut out of it. It's almost like if you think it's the best thing to do, do it in a way that actually gets more people on board versus.
That's the thing. They say that this is their process, and see, what they're communicating to the public is that this is our process for procurement, and this is how we're supposed to move forward. This is what the law says we're supposed to do, and then when we reach a conclusion or negotiate a deal, then people can discuss it, and that's what's given the public, you know, some discomfort. It's because
they prefer it the other way around.
We want to all be in on the deal as it's happening. And the JEA says that that's not the way it works.
And the deal would, let's be clear, the deal would net this city anywhere from $3 billion to maybe up to $7
billion. It's probably going
to
be 7 or 8 is the expected price tag.
$7 to $8 billion if it goes through.
Well, yeah, you've been saying netting it. It will get $7 to $8 billion, but you know, the way that money gets broken up is...
Sure. And
it's a totally different story.
It's the lack of transparency over how that money would be broken up, I think, that is causing so much discomfort. How will this money be spent? Why isn't the public being sold the case for how this money would be used? Now, I'm going to quote here from another mild-mannered column from the Times Union's Nate Monroe. He's well-known for his soft touch and diplomacy. He writes, "The sale of JEA will radically change city government forever. It will touch the everyday lives of nearly every resident in the city. It's being done dishonestly, based on a bed of trumped-up claims and falsehoods. Curry wants to use the sale proceeds to pay down the city's debt, a political gimmick so he can say that it would make Jacksonville the country's first debt-free city. No part of that statement would be true. Jacksonville would neither be the first city without debt, nor would it be a city without debt at all. It would still possess more than $3 billion in pension debt. In either case, the city would have no debt only until future mayors and councils decided to borrow money."
And that's what we've discussed many times on this media roundtable, is what project will be the first one to get bonded by the city and assume more debt. Yeah. And we can think of a few big ones, I'm sure.
Yeah. And Melissa, you know, another thing, that these are all important issues that we're all talking about, but people, too, what they care about most, too, is, you know what, my electricity bill is going to go up. This is what this means. I was talking with a couple of people just this week about that, and they said, you know what, this means higher bills for us. This means what's going to happen when
that's
there's an outage.
That's certainly the fear.
Yes, the accountability that we have right now is you call JEA, you call the city, they're going to make it happen. So what happens when it's a private company? Something happens. That company can take its time with getting your power back on, getting your sewage back to working, whatever it may be.
A number of listeners have also pointed out to us out on the West Coast, the power company PG&E has come under a lot of criticism. Rolling brownouts have really angered power customers out there. So people are envisioning this parade of horribles that might happen if we have, say, Florida Power and Light or Duke running our power in Jacksonville. Now, to be fair, these are companies with a decent customer service reputation, Florida Power and Light especially. That said, the loss of local control is what at least some members of the city council are sounding the alarm about. There have been some independent voices that have emerged and said, hold on here, you know, we don't need to rush Foursquare into this city.
I think that there definitely is a my bill might go up sort of fears. Mm-hmm. But in talking to people, there's also almost more just an existential, philosophical sort of, we own this.
Yeah.
And it's being basically taken from the citizens who own it and being sold without their consent, which just for you know, at least some of the people that we talk to, it just bothers them on like a gut level. Yes, there are some very, very good privately held or publicly owned utilities, you know, not municipal owned, that do a great job and have great customer satisfaction, and the bills might not go up. But that's different from kind of the philosophical, if we the people of Jacksonville own this, there's a sense that we, the people of Jacksonville, should have more of a role in deciding this out.
Yeah, and also,
let me just get a few more tweets on the air. Here's one. It's a good thing they can't sell the St. John's River or the beach. Matt tweets the show.
Don't give him ideas.
One of the mayor's donors was the one that started the whole thing with his innocent suggestion about selling JEA on his last day as a JEA board member.
Well, actually, this conversation has been going on for years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've been having this, but it's always kind of come up and gone back down. But there is tremendous community benefit for owning the utility, and I think the public is aware of that, because you get to weigh in on things, you get to have a voice in how the utility is run. If it's owned privately, you don't really get to have a voice in how it's run. You know, the board of directors do that, and the shareholders do that, and they keep it moving. So the community benefit may be worth more than $7 or $8 billion.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call here on the Friday Media Roundtable. Now, also this week, speaking of privatizing things, there are new reports that the city of Jacksonville may be looking to privatize downtown parking. Just one day after he resigned from the board of the Downtown Investment Authority, business owner Dane Gray of Elite Parking Services of America is asking the city of Jax to give him a 30-year contract to manage city parking. This would give Elite Parking the authority to set rates for downtown parking meters and parking garages. The city has seen deals like this backfire in the past, so it's an open question as to whether they would approve this. But Elite says it would give us a lot of upgrades on downtown parking equipment and garages, make all kinds of improvements. You could pay for parking by using a smartphone app and other types of changes that a lot of other cities have already gone to.
It's so interesting, the reaction to this, and it really has to be broken into different streams. There was, if you look online, an absolute knee-jerk reaction of DIA board member resigns in order to join the JEA board, which, you know, some stuff's happened in there. The day after he resigns, he submits this unsolicited proposal. It does have people kind of going, just the optics are bad. I think that that's probably worth discussing, but after that, I think there's also a discussion about how Jacksonville should do its parking, which is a separate thing, which is I personally find interesting, but, you know.
Right. Could the city adopt some of these smartphone technologies to make parking easier for everyone?
The city can do it. Why not? Yeah. Why not look into, there's a city app. They're Jack's Ready. They're different types of app now. And I think you're right, Tim. It goes back to, there's a little shade in that, where you just have this gentleman, like you said, unsolicited, comes and give this a day after, and then he's maybe on the JEA board. Something people are looking at that.
It's the appearance of cronyism that upsets people.
No, here's the thing. He knows a lot about parking. I mean, this is his life. He started his company in his dorm room.
And he's been very successful.
Exactly. So there is a logic of, DIA has done a study that looked at parking. He's the guy who lives and breathes parking. So, of course he'd come up with these ideas.
He's also saying that they'd set up a shuttle service to bring people into downtown from outlying garages. So these are all common sense ideas that would improve probably parking. The question is, do you want that in public or private hands?
Well, also, you have to remember the last time that we talked about moving parking outside the city core and having people kind of get shuttled in is how we got the Skyway. So, it's like if you love the Skyway, what we can do next isn't the best,
And also,
would people park in an outlying garage and then get on a bus? Essentially, it'd be a bus, right? Yeah. To come downtown.
Yeah, and that was basically the idea with the Skyway, is that we move parking out of the urban core, we put it along the periphery, and you Skyway in, and I think there's a jump ball.
How many riders a day does it get?
Well, but we didn't move parking out of downtown.
Well, we're not a city of commuters. As a New York City kid, I got used to taking the subway and the bus everywhere. It didn't matter my car stayed at home. Here, people want their car right next to their job so they can get their stuff, and that's just convenience. That's the mindset. That's why not a lot of people, unless they have to, ride JTA.
Well, culture change would definitely have to be a part of any consideration for what services are being offered outside of the area of downtown. But also, I think what's lost in this piece is that they wouldn't be able to privatize this without doing a bid. I don't think they can just award.
There'd be a process. Yeah, so getting back to what you said, there's a process.
Yeah, there's a process. So
let's get a few more callers on. Bonnie is in Jacksonville Beach. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to commend the city council members that are standing up and questioning and at least choosing to look deeper into the sale of JEA. But at the same time, I think it's important that we not lose sight that overall, the history since this new city council has been elected has been a little bit of a rough one. We've gotten a lawsuit from a local pastor for freedom of speech, a lawsuit from parents for the school board tax referendum, a lawsuit from the school board on the tax referendum, so that's three lawsuits. We've had 124 deaths, and we've had over, I think it's now 295 shootings, but 124 of those resulted in death. JSO budget has increased, and although they did implement Cure the Violence, many people said it was not enough. I believe Cure the Violence was less than $1 million is what was dedicated to it. And I don't know how we at this time could be worried about parking when we can't solve these major issues that are going on. But I, for one, would like to see stronger leadership from city council addressing and the mayor addressing a long-range plan on how to fix some of the core issues and how to bring more small business owners into the downtown core area.
All right, Bonnie. Thanks for that. Philip is on the south side. Go ahead, Philip. Philip, you're on the air.
All right. Yes, I wanted to address with your panel, I too am a little skeptical about the sale of JEA. I'm trying to keep an open mind about it, but I've heard it mentioned before that if the proceeds were properly applied to eliminating the pension debt that the city is now under, you know, would that not put us in a very advantageous position financially going forward to be able to address some of the critical needs that that the city has in terms of infrastructure, school refurbishment, things like that?
Sure. Yeah, Philip, thank you for that.
We passed a referendum to address the pension debt.
Right. But so, I mean, I think the overarching idea is, however the money is actually used, whether it's used to pay off the pension debt and then we use the funding that would have gone to the pension debt for other things. But yeah, the city having a bag of money that it could use for stuff, if you want the city to do stuff, having a bag of money is a good thing. Having a bag of money is always a good thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the argument that when this eventually gets to the point where JEA and City Hall makes the case, you can expect that will be the argument. If we sell it, we would then have this money to
can
do
you
stuff.
Imagine, can you imagine all of the people, you know, looking to feed at the trough of $8 billion? All of the things.
Meanwhile, here's a take from Joe. He emails us, the lack of knowledge on your panel of what it takes for a major acquisition involving publicly traded companies is noticeable but not surprising. When all is said and done, no deal is done until the people vote. And my property with Florida Power and Light is much better served and has lower rates. Its disaster recovery is much better than JEA, he says. So there you go, guys.
I'm not quite sure what that insult means, but
okay. Yeah, for the record, I think Tim in particular is very well versed on the ins and outs of this sale as a business editor, but that's, you know, my biased take. Emmanuel is in St. John's County. Hi, Emmanuel. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I wanted to comment on the JEA part. I mean, they're trying to sell JEA. The company that's going to buy JEA is in for profit. They're buying it to make money. So why, if it's the corruption there, why don't they change the board and everything so that they can make money as the same company that's going to buy JEA will be able to make money out of it? Because they are not going to buy the JEA in for loss. They're going to make profit out of it. So the city should be able to make profit out of JEA to be able to use that profit to improve whatever they wanted to do. So I think it's an inside thing that they wanted to do. It's a corruption going on over there.
Emmanuel, thanks for that. And that sort of feeds into the public perception many have around this whole process. Here's a tweet from A1A Solar. Full disclosure, they're an underwriter on this program. I think it's the first time they've ever tweeted us. They write, anyone who thinks they really have a say in what JEA does is delusional. Just look at what they did with net metering last year. Yes, the utility made a change to its net metering program that customers were really unhappy with.
That was a change. And if you have solar panels and you basically send energy back to the utility, how much do you get paid for it? And JEA had been giving customers more money and then cut how much they were given. To the earlier comment, the argument that JEA would make is that a private owner of the utility has leeway to do things that a municipal-owned utility could not do, that they can invest in different things. I'll say that's an open question. That's JEA's position, is that if they sell it, the new owner has more flexibility, wouldn't have to raise rates, but can make money in other ways. There are people who disagree with that.
And we're getting a call from another listener. He wanted to say that Duke Energy has a bad reputation in terms of customer service and environmental stewardship. We don't have time to get that one on the air, though, because we need to move on and make note of one other big story from the week. Bye-bye, Jalen Ramsey. Yes, the Jaguars traded Ramsey to the Los Angeles Rams this week. Somewhat miraculously, the cornerback has somehow quickly recovered from his back injuries just in time to play on Sunday. Now, as all of this is happening, the Jaguars are frantically trying to scrub all memories of Ramsey from TIAA Bank Field. It's not easy to remove all images of an all-pro. you know, public opinion among all the fans out there is really divided on whether the team did a good enough job of managing Ramsey's ego and also trying to keep him in the fold, given that he was such an outstanding player. What do you guys think?
You know, Melissa, I found it interesting that you say, you know, how he recovered miraculously from the back injuries. I also found it interesting that, remember, he had the flu and yet went to go see his newborn baby.
But he was doing much better by then.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because I'm saying you can't see a newborn, but I'm not judging. You know,
whether or not you approve of Jalen Ramsey's tactics, it's an interesting Rorschach test for people. Some people see him as just being a smart, tough negotiator, standing up for himself, you know, demanding to get what he thinks he's worth. Others see him as a diva.
Yeah, it's interesting because people kind of look at the way the NFL, this action, Jalen Ramsey's action, as like an NBA player. The NBA has guaranteed contracts, NFL doesn't. They have signing bonuses. And this is the only way, per their negotiated NFL Players Association deal, that the loopholes allow him to maneuver in this way in order to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. And so from a perspective of the player, if you are someone who's looking from a player perspective because they know that they are the product, you know, they are the commodity here, if he's looking to get his value and he realizes he's not going to get it here, this is his way of exercising, you know, his wants. And he did a masterful job.
Sure. Now, how do you assess the Jaguars front office and the way they handle those? What do you guys say?
I'll put it this way. The Jaguars over the last 11 years, their 11 first round draft picks, only one has been a Pro Bowl player. And you can guess which one that is.
Mm-hmm. There is the one
who's playing for the Rams now.
There's an interesting management question here. You know, if you look at the coverage of the issues that he had with the front office, I'm not deep enough into that to draw any lessons from it, but there, you know, is that question in any office of, if you have a star performer, what do you do to keep that person happy? And there is a sense that the team was playing hardball with what they wanted to pay him and some other players as well. And, you know, to Charles's point, I think the idea that if you're going to play hardball, people will play hardball back. And
yeah.
And here we are. Okay. With 2 minutes left until the break, it's finally time for our lightning round. I wish I had a sound effect of a bolt of lightning coming down.
We'll find one for
we'll
you,
work
Melissa.
On that. Okay, other stories we might have missed from the week, beginning with Dan Scanlon.
All right, full disclosure, I'm one of the volunteers involved in a Star Trek film studio in Kingsland, Georgia, and they're holding a fan appreciation weekend starting today at 1 o'clock, then 9 to 5 is 9 to 6 Saturday and Sunday. It is 10,000 square feet. It is a replica of the original Star Trek sets, the Shatner era, and we've got some guest stars, including Bijou Trimble, the woman who single-handedly in 1966 saved Star Trek with a letter-writing campaign.
Nice.
So there.
Cool.
And I'll be there, and if you show up, I'll tell you all about it.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like a lot of fun. Get out there, Trekkies.
And Melissa, I told Dan he could have my time and talk about his Star Trek. Because he loves it. He's showing me a picture.
You yield back your time to the gentleman on my right.
Exactly.
Oh, we get pictures.
I won't reclaim my time, Dan. I won't reclaim my time.
Unlike Maxine Waters, you are not reclaiming your time. Tim Gibbons.
We might have planned to talk about the Internet Cafe's situation. I just find fascinating. A whole long, complicated story I can't get into here, obviously. But the thing I find most fascinating about it is how this story will not die. People in Jacksonville,
yes,
by and large, don't want Internet Cafes. They pop up.
They're zombie-like.
It's amazing. And the legal theories behind them are fascinating if you're into that sort of thing.
But they're usually only on certain parts of town. But that's a whole other discussion we'll have to have.
Yep. Charles.
Yeah, finally, the new gas pipes are being installed at the Valencia Way apartments. That horrible situation over there where the gas has been out and people have been without hot water, in the case that they've been forced to. Some people, what we understand, have been forced to shower outside in conditions. Yeah, and so that's finally being
being addressed.
Yeah, so.
Well, thank you for all of that, Charles, Tim, Angela, and Dan. Have a great weekend, guys. Thank you. Up next, Caring Chefs takes over Avenue Mall. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Our most basic instinct is to protect our families. Safety belts and properly installed child seats do that. They prevent injuries and deaths.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features resort lifestyle amenities which allow residents to remain active and vibrant. The new alternative to long-term care insurance. 901-4004. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
It's unprecedented for the children of a president to be working for a business that enriches them and the president while in office.
It's not just adult children trying to enrich themselves thanks to their connection to a president.
The ethical questions that come from this arrangement this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we're talking about the links between policing and our physical and mental health. American policing has changed a lot in the last several decades, becoming more proactive. But a growing body of research suggests that this sort of policing might have unintended health consequences. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Congress has told Rudy Giuliani's behavior risked blowing everything up like a hand grenade. Also, Elizabeth Warren comes under fire in Ohio. Her rivals do more than just smile for the camera.
She was more specific and forthcoming about the number of selfies she's taken than about how this plan is going to be funded.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it is the First Coast's first, biggest, and best food and wine tasting event. Every year, more than 1,500 hungry guests fill up the Avenues Mall, sampling incredible cuisine and drinks from around Northeast Florida. Caring Chefs brings together dozens of this region's finest chefs, sommeliers, and brewers, all to raise much-needed funds to help our community's kids and families. You can check out the 36th annual Caring Chefs this weekend. We're pleased to welcome David Cognetta, Distinguished Gifts Manager, Jessica Henderson, Director of Program Operations, both with the Children's Home Society. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having
us. Jessica, let's start with you. This is just a much-loved event on the First Coast, the 36th annual Caring Chefs. It's taking over the Avenues Mall Sunday. Let's begin. For those that have never been, set the scene for us. Describe what they'll experience.
It is a fabulous event. We fill this mall with just the best restaurants in Jacksonville. And the most exciting part is our community that comes out. We have more than 1,500 people that show each year. And it's just a good time with great food, friends, live music.
Who all is providing food and drinks this year?
This year, we have some exciting new restaurants. River and Post will be joining us. Sawgrass is a favorite of ours that comes.
Yeah, this year we have Well Oiled Events is another newcomer. But we have 19 at TBC Sawgrass, Wicked Barley, Bold City, Bistro X, Three Forks, just a whole bunch.
So one ticket, you just get to walk the mall and try everything, right?
Yes. So one ticket costs $75, and that's for general admission. And the event is this Sunday from 7 to 9:30, and you get to walk the mall. The mall's closed, so you just walk around, and you get to eat a lot of yummy food.
Yeah.
And have some good drinks, and just have a good time with family or friends, whoever you choose to come with.
Can you buy tickets right on site?
You can. Tickets are still available online until noon today.
Okay.
That's VIP and general admission. And that's at chscaringchefs.org. You can still buy them till noon. But after 12 o'clock today, you can walk up to the mall starting at 6:45 Sunday night. And at the food court entrance, buy tickets for general admission.
And this is like no regular food court, by the way. This will be an incredibly high-end experience. Let's talk about the Children's Home Society of Florida. Tell us about what folks' tickets are helping to support.
Right. So we've been here serving the First Coast for more than 100 years. And our roots are really grounded in foster care and adoption. But recently, we've changed our direction. We're going upstream to remove the need for foster care as we know it. 75% of kids that are in foster care are there for fixable family issues. And so we really are targeting those preventative services that keep the need from kids coming into care.
Right. We're talking about everything from mental health issues, domestic violence, addiction, poor family structure, medical needs kids have. There's a whole range of needs. You support these kids cradle to career, correct?
That is correct. We like to say that we'd like to have the children ready to grow, ready to learn, ready for college or career, and when it's appropriate, ready to parent.
Yeah.
And through the different services and programs we provide, it's really about keeping the children and families safe, strong, and together.
And it's amazing how long you've been in this community. You're one of the oldest nonprofits in the community, I believe.
There's
only a few that have a longer tenure.
I think Daniel Kids has a speed
Daniel
by
Kids.
A little bit. Yes.
That's the only one I can think of. Yeah.
Yes. But 100 years in this community, we serve more than 10,000 families, and we've expanded statewide to really replicate these quality programs that have served the Northeast for so long.
Wow. Okay. So with all of that said, this is such a fun, easy way to support the Children's Home Society of Florida. What a legacy they have in our community and across the state. It is the 36th annual Caring Chefs event. If you love food, you want to sample wine and new craft breweries from around the area, you really don't want to miss this. With one ticket, you get to taste it all. This is happening Sunday night, 7 p.m. at the Avenues Mall. You can buy your tickets now until noon today online at chscaringchefs.org. You can buy tickets on site if you want to do that. In Jacksonville, people have a tendency to do that. So they make that last minute decision to go to something. Again, it's Caring Chefs Sunday night at the Avenues Mall. The fun begins at 7 p.m. So David Cognetta, Jessica Henderson, both with the Children's Home Society of Florida, have fun. I wish I could be there. I have a prior commitment, or I would definitely go because it's really, really cool. Thank you so much and have a great time.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Station news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you missed anything and you had a feedback point or a comment, we want your emails. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to listen live at noon today as our statewide show, The Florida Roundup, looks at the Ukraine scandal and Florida connections to the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. We'll also examine recent efforts in Tallahassee to get Florida engaged more fully in addressing climate change. Both of those coming up at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. And if you're catching our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for some great music. We'll be back, meanwhile, here locally at 9 a.m. Monday morning. Whatever you do this weekend, enjoy yourself. See you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.